I was given first drafts of the script as soon as they had them.
Fellow Ozzyans, the Wicked Witch of the West is dead.
That was a real luxury. John would start sending me first look development shots and stuff like that of the world building. So I can start to visualize in my head, you know, pretty early on what Oz could look like.
Don't let her get away!
2 weeks before production, that's really where I started to get in there and walk the sets and go to the war room, which was like this gigantic room where they had all the drawings and models of everything. So it was just like this dream, but it was also, you know, really intimidating to walk into a room like that. And then as soon as they're shooting, then you realize how big it is. 2 films worth of footage, 8 months, 155 days of shooting, 250 hours of dailies. It could be really overwhelming at times. You're literally sitting there with your blank timeline saying, where do I start?
We're back. If you're listening for the first time, welcome. If you have ever wondered what it takes to work on big budget Hollywood films, this is the place to find out. We get to hear from those working in the film industry, editors, VFX artists, sound designers, the unsung heroes who never get to see the spotlight or even really see the light of day because they're typically locked away in a dark room cranking away, making the magic happen. So we took a bit of a break, but we're finally back and we've got a fun one. This episode features Myron Kirstein. He's the editor of Zach Braff's Garden State, Crazy Rich Asians, In the Heights, and part one of the 2-part film adaptation of a little musical called Wicked. We talk about how he started in the film industry, how he arrived to working on the film, his editing process of tackling such a massive undertaking, and he even shares a little bit of an update about where they're at in the making of part two of Wicked. So without further ado, let's dive in. Myron, so good to have you on here. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Gavin. Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here. I'm really excited to take a deep dive into Wicked and post-production and hopefully give you some insight of what we do here.
To rewind a little bit, I'd love to hear how you arrived to kind of this moment of working on Wicked. I'd love to hear about your journey into the world of editorial. How'd you start and how'd you end up here?
Yeah, in college, I definitely had the bug to work in film. And when I graduated, I thought the best place to go was not LA, but was to New York. And I landed on this amazing TV show called TV Nation, which was essentially a precursor to The Daily Show and Colbert Report. And it was a political satire, news magazine style show. And it was amazing because it was the best of the best of writing. And then these editors, there was 8 editors that worked on the show. And everyone respected the fact that I just wanted to learn and just be a sponge. By the end of the first season, I was an assistant editor. And I was rewarded by this huge network of editors, 8 editors that would all call upon me to do work in New York. And they hired me on my first union gig, which was Sex and the City as an assistant editor, the first season of Sex and the City. Finally, I stumbled upon my mentor by the name of Jim Lyons, who cut all of Todd Haynes' early films. And I worked with him on my first musical, Velvet Goldmine, which was about Bowie and Iggy Pop and, you know, the whole glam rock scene. It was just this crash course of like awesome indie filmmaking. Pete Sollett, who was a young and up and coming director, saw that movie and saw something in me. And we worked on Raising Victor Vargas. And that was a big New York darling of a film that people really responded to. Zach Braff saw that movie and said, I want to hire this guy. And that's how I got Garden State. And that's how I got my first films in Hollywood. And I just kept building my career. I didn't have any money. I just needed to keep working. If I ever had the opportunity to pick something, I tried my best to pick the right project. I didn't always do that. All these things ended up eventually leading me to John Chu and working on Crazy Rich Asians because, you know, I had a variety of friends that knew him. And when I met him, he didn't know me from Adam. He just liked Garden State. And I just said that I would just kill it for you. And please, I'd just beg of you to hire me on this film. and I'll give you 200%. And I suckered him in somehow, and he hired me. And, you know, we just ended up building this really beautiful bromance, co-conspirator collaboration to make Crazy Rich Asians and then In the Heights and then to Wicked. We just ended up like raising the bar for each other. And it's odd because, you know, you never, when you're first starting, you don't know how you're going to get there. The only thing I just say is that it was, like I said, it was just supposed to happen this way, and knew what I wanted to do was to make art for a living. Filmmaking just happened to be my medium.
To find someone like John in the partnership in that, like you said, a brotherhood, how do you, you talked about how you tried your best to pick the right projects, even if that didn't always happen. What do you feel like now looking back are some of the ways that you would pick the right project?
You know, if I responded to the script in some ways, when I read Garden State, I just knew that there was something special in the writing. And I felt very connected to the themes that Zach was writing about. And then other times, you know, it's just kind of random. You're just like, oh, I want to work with that actor, or that DP's on it, or that producer is doing it. Frankly, sometimes it's just like, I need the money. You know, even after I had established myself in Hollywood, you know, they stopped making $20 or $30 million comedies, which I was doing with Paul Weitz. This was before the streaming boom happened. And for a while, I didn't think I was going to make any movies. I thought I was done. I thought I was in editor's jail because, you know, some of my films just hadn't taken off and they weren't making them.
You said that, you know, things kind of fell in your lap. But what I hear is you actually being up for a lot and saying, you know, stepping up to the plate and being like, yes, like I'm in, I'm available, I can do this. And I feel like it takes a lot of that initiative to get into the right opportunity, right? If you say yes enough times, something will work. And that takes a lot.
I think the advice I give to a lot of up and coming editors or assistant editors is just don't say no to anything. And it's not that I don't think I'm want something better sometimes. It's just that you can always say no later. Or if it doesn't work out, then so be it. But to say no right away, you're just closing like doors very quickly. And so if you open all the doors, whether it's the right project or not, I just think it gives you more chances of finding your John M. Chu. And that's exactly what happened. I just opened up every freaking door in front of me. And sometimes I wish I hadn't, but most of the times it just led me down the path of where I would end up with John. And also, you know, like what Lynn would say in Hamilton, like, you know, once you get in the door, once you're in the room where it happens, you know, once you get your shot, you got to take it. Leading with your heart and your enthusiasm and not being snobby is the best approach. And unless you're, you know, a billionaire, I don't see what other choice there is. Like, you just have to create opportunities because there's 1,000 people like me. There's 1,000 people like every part of this business, all after the same job. And you, the only way to differentiate yourself is by enthusiasm and creating opportunity. You know, when I was an assistant editor, they used to have this building called the Brill Building, which was very famous in New York. Where a lot of post-production was happening, everything from the Coen brothers to Spike Lee to Scorsese, everybody was like cutting this building, you know, and I used to slip my resume under everyone's doors, hoping that somebody would call me for a job. Nobody ever did. Nobody. I never got one call. It doesn't matter. I'm going to make it somehow. You have to have that attitude because Hollywood, they don't care. It's a business. You just have to differentiate yourself. You have to fight, you know, to get in that door.
Now on the other side of part one of what is one of the most famous musicals ever, I would say something worked. So yeah, let's talk Wicked. You know, we're focused on post, but I'd love to hear from the post angle what it's like working in pre-production and production as the editor. How soon are you getting involved? And then were there any unique differences in how you approached Wicked and working with John Chu?
I was given first drafts of the script as soon as they had them. And so that was a real luxury to be able to read the scripts and think about them and really immerse myself in the storytelling from a script stage. And then John would start sending me first look development shots and stuff like that of, you know, of the world building. So I could start to visualize in my head, you know, pretty early on what Oz could look like. And of course, that was really exciting because, you know, I'd never seen anything like that. It's like I was a kid in the candy store sort of living the dream of returning to Oz meets Star Wars meets Lord of the Rings. It just felt epic. Pre-production ended up heating up. You know, I tried to insert myself as much as I could into any meetings, any VFX roundtable meetings, discussions, what have you. Anything I could sort of get in there, even if they weren't paying me, I just try to insert myself in there. And then 2 weeks before production, that's really where I started to get in there and walk the sets and go to the war room, which was like this gigantic room where they had all the drawings and models of everything and Paul Tazewell's drawings of his costumes. And I really got a sense of how immense the undertaking was. At that point, I was like, oh my God, this is so much bigger than any one of us. And so it was just like this dream, but it was also, you know, really intimidating to walk into a room like that. And then as soon as they're shooting, then you realize how big it is, you know, the amount of footage, the 2 films worth of footage. It could be really overwhelming at times. You're literally sitting there with your blank timeline saying, where do I start? The good news is over the course of my career, been able to develop a process that seems to work really, really well for me. And that's basically go in a screening room, lock myself up, have my laptop, take notes, and watch an hour or 3 hours, 4 hours of dailies start to finish. Take notes. Don't do markers. Don't pull selects. Just let it wash over you like an audience member and take it all in. Like you are the first person to experience Yellow Brick Road or Elphaba or Glinda. From there, build out selects, build out the film, build out scenes, build out performances. No different than cutting the smallest indie film. My approach isn't any different. It's just that the scale and the amount of footage is a lot more. But I found that not changing that process and not getting too overwhelmed by the sheer magnitude of what I was dealing with to be really helpful. Otherwise, I could really kind of fall apart, sink, because, it, you know, otherwise you can, it's all a head game. You know, as soon as you start to think about it too much and that the stakes are so high for the studio and everyone there, you know, anybody's going to buckle from that. If you're like, okay, this is my process. This is what I do every day. This is my ritual. No different than a baseball player sort of lacing up for a game. Like, this is what I do to do my work. And I'm going to do it the same way every day. And I'm going to do it over 8 months, 155 days of shooting, 250 hours of dailies, and just do the work, because doing the work is all that it's about.
Talk more about that. How did you bring on, you know, assistant editors, teammates? How big is the team? Where do you start with that?
Well, first of all, I started with my my first Lara Cuccioni. I just said to her, like, we had to build the best team in the UK, and we have to build the best team in the US that have to love each other. Otherwise, we're going to kill each other over the process of 2 years. So she was very thorough to build this incredible UK team. I ended up hiring this amazing VFX editor that was able to come over to the UK with us named Ed Marsh. Recently, he worked on Oppenheimer, worked on Titanic. He had seen it all. And so I knew I needed like the best VFX editor to help teach me how to, you know, do these big movies. And then I hired Jack Dolman, who is the most amazing music editor you could ever meet. This guy live and breathes music. He, on his spare time at the edit room, he's trying to learn this Bach piece. So you just hear him playing piano. I had to have the, you know, what I called like the Avengers of post-production to have my back and keep me organized and keep me from drowning in every capacity, from like finding the right live vocals to how to cut something on a grid if I was off a little bit, or if I need to find amazing temp music to be able to help guide the composer or to present for screenings. this team was everything to this process. And also, frankly, I just needed humanity around me. I needed like really kind, beautiful people that could, that I could have fun with, tell jokes with, just, you know, have a really good time. Like, I instituted this thing both in the UK and the US to take lunches together that nobody eats at their desk, and just to build community. It wasn't enough for me to cut an amazing film. I wanted it to become a community and a place that people wanted to show up to. And I also wanted to become, you know, in my head, what would be good, a good leader, you know, to these people, not just a good boss, but a good leader. And take also what I think John brings to the production side, which is just this person that people want to fight for, you know, that want to just bust their butts for. And I wanted the same thing in post-production.
And it sounds like you did that, getting through what sounds like a massive amount of footage over, you know, what has been many, many years by the time part two comes out as well. It just seems like, yeah, you've done a really good job of investing in the team. And I kind of wanted to talk about some of the things throughout the film. It opens with a oner, and there are a lot of complex, long shots and moves throughout the entire film. I was curious what it's like to work with those, editing those together. Did you have lots of takes to choose from, or are you having to do a lot of stitching, you know, going into those moments? How's that all working?
On that particular shot, it was basically picking the hat shot and everything else was going to be CG. But, you know, that hat shot used to be a much longer. It used to start off a drop of water, and that drop of water then turns to a stream, and you go up the stairs, and then you find the bucket, and then the hat. And it took a really long time for that to happen. And the studio was already worried that the opening shot took so long. So I was speeding it up. I was doing everything I could. I was like jump cutting it. I was dissolving it. You know, it's just like working with the real basics of one shot. But then once you pick it, it was my job and John's job was to then communicate what to do after that. And so there wasn't a clear plan. There was, you know, there was a sort of the idea that you would go through the window and then see part of the castle and then, you know, see, you know, the rainbow of the waterfall and then our Wizard of Oz characters and then Emerald City. But, you know, that could have been done 3,000 different ways. And so it was literally John with like an iPhone and a stick, you know, in post-production trying to communicate how this work. And, you know, the studio was like, the shot's too long. And then we're like, okay, what if we just cut into the bucket, but, you know, get the shot done. And then they're like, please turn it over because this is going to take a year to make. So you have to be really patient and you're fighting off the studio and the studio's like, you should cut that shot. It's too expensive. You're like, no, just be patient. It's going to be amazing when it's done. But at the same time, you have to make the rest of the film work. That way they feel confident in your choices. And that gives you a little bit more goodwill from the studio because rightly so, they're scared about everything. So even the simplest shot, even though I'm not doing a whole lot in the very beginning to pick like the plate per se to start the shot, there's a lot of things going on with the politics and working with the VFX vendors and stuff that has nothing to do with the editing, but more about all the other stuff, which is takes up 90% of your time basically doing for 2 years in post.
And you were delayed a bit with the writer's strike, right?
Yeah, writers and SAG. The good news is we had 99% of film one and 85% of film two in the can. The bad news is on the first movie, what was missing was Defying Gravity, which is our finale to our movie. And so of all the things that we could be missing. So we're definitely a little slack-jawed about like, okay, we don't have the ending of our movie, which all builds to Defying Gravity. And, you know, it was scheduled that way because Cynthia had to train for basically 8 months to be able to perform that stunt work and sing live at the same time. So it was purposely put at the end of the schedule. And it gave us a second chance to plan for the shot making for Defying Gravity. And if anything, it gave us a little time also away from the footage while John was prepping after the strike. Ivan did this huge experiment of the first movie where it just cut out half of the scenes and turned half of them black and white and just kind of like did this aggressive cut to see what should be in the film, what shouldn't, because I wanted to be able to break it as much as possible while he was away prepping the the finishing principle. And he came back from finishing shooting Defying Gravity. He's like, okay, just brace yourself. Do you mind watching this crazy cut? And it's like, and he was like, yeah. I was like, do you want the rest of the team there? And it's like, sure. And you know, it was like the weirdest freaking experience ever. But you know, taking those big swings and him like saying, okay, I see that there's certain things that we could try because of your crazy experiments, and there's some things like we're never gonna do. But I told him, I was like, you're about to watch something only. Not that any of these are going to be in the film, but I just want to be able to crack your brain open a little bit and give you other ways, other experiences. I want you to like feel some of these things I'm kicking the tires on. And it did exactly what it did. It opened up a lot of discussions, and we ended up doing this scene where Madame Morble's writing to the wizard, which was never scripted. And at first we're like, oh my God, are we going to be able to finish this movie, you know, because of the strike? And then it just ended up really being this blessing for this movie.
It took a bit to get the movie even greenlit and off the ground. And then to be facing strikes at that point in the game had to be pretty discouraging. It's so cool that you used the time to really experiment, because if anything, you built a stronger relationship with John to show that you're still up for trying something new and innovating. And I think that's really important too for an editor in the relationship with any director, but especially one they've partnered multiple times with, is to show, hey, I'm not getting lazy here. I'm not getting, you know, like I'm just resting back on my laurels, but I'm always up for innovating. And I think that's a really cool principle that you exemplified throughout that process.
I found every movie I've done that with ended up giving me, even if it's one or two new answers, like I just find that something really helpful, you know, let's make this feel like a horror film in the first half, or how do we make this tone feel really melodramatic? Like I could utilize my music editors to experiment with different tones. Like I could say, like, I love this scene the way it is. It's perfect. But what's a different take on this tonally? Because then they would inspire me to try something different editorially. Like, I just had all these ways to experiment with my co-conspirators. You know, I could go to Ed Marsh and was like, can you get, VFX to do like a post-viz of this shot? Like, and then I could pitch it to John. Like, I think maybe we need a wide of the arrival to Shiz here. You know, just things that I can try that, you know, can be expensive, but mostly not. It's just when you have people who are game to do that with, because some people, their attitude could be like, what is he doing now? And you're like, I'm just remaking the film while John's away. Don't worry. It's going to be fine. None of it's going to go in, but can you guys like redo like half the stuff? And they're like, you crazy mad scientist guy. And you know, at the same time, you don't want to drive people crazy. You want to say, I have this itch, I don't know why, you know. And yeah, John really respects that, because he, you know, he comes from, you know, he knows how to edit, he knows how to make things like he, but so having that sort of spirit about it, that you just sort of like, there's something else here, I don't know what it is, but I need to scratch that itch somehow, is a really good attitude in general, especially when there's problems and you don't know how to solve them. And you're just like, I need to like tear this thing apart, or I need to, there's something about it. And also to take screenings in the same way. When you screen, I'm a real believer in screening for audiences or friends and family, and just get people to say good things to you, but also bad things to you, and say things that like, they're not even constructive. They're just like, I hate it. You're just like, okay, can you give me something else other than I hate it? Like, I don't know. I'm not connecting the character. Like, okay, that's something. Why? Really makes for a better film.
You used a lot of really fun and unique cuts to the rhythm. I'm a drummer, and so I loved your intentionality of cutting to like the rhythmic hits synced up with like the music and sound design. You know, you'd see her hit the bed or turn their head, or like they'd shut a bookcase or like something, you know, as it's all hitting with the music and the sound.
What is this feeling so sudden and new?
I felt the moment I laid eyes on you.
My pulse is rushing.
My head is reeling.
Yeah, well, my face is flushing.
What is this feeling
Is that something that you knew you always wanted to do that was like laid out in the storyboards, or was that something that comes to you once you're in it?
There's no storyboards that I refer to or previs or anything to inform how I cut things musically. I just feel like it's from exploring the footage and what, you know, and sometimes, you know, with, you know, like a sequence, like What Is This Feeling, you know, there's a very short rhythmic cadence to things that I'm cutting to. Whereas, you know, Defying Gravity is very fluid, and I'm not ever like really cutting to a rhythm or something. It's all about emotion and storytelling. The tit for tat nature of What Is This Feeling, the frenemy montage, should be really sharp and have this sort of kind of attitude to it that I thought was appropriate to the cutting style. And of course, we had split screens, we had a lot of different things, multiple cameras, I had overlapping choreography between locations. All those things sort of helped dictate how I was going to cut things. And John wasn't telling me to do it. There wasn't storyboards. I just felt like that was just something that felt like it should be cut that way at the time, and that it should be this, there's a sharpness versus, you know, The Wizard and I, you know, is very like Sound of Music, sort of traditional building, watching somebody cross over shiz, and it's just a feeling. What I love about all the songs, and I have a particular pride in, especially with Wicked, is that they all build in these really incredible ways, and it's just this. There's something inherently in how I approach footage and how John and Alice Brooks, the DP, inspired me and found a different way of cutting musicals I had ever had. Whereas on In the Heights or Tick, Tick, Boom, I was much more aggressive. If anything, there was a little bit more of a restraint to how I was cutting the musical numbers this time around.
Where are you at in part two?
We have basically a rough advanced assembly of the movie. We're getting into John's director's cut. And we're currently on hiatus for November to promote the movie. And John just had a baby, so he needed a little time with the family. In a week, we are going to crack it back open. It's going to be off to the races to try to finish in time in a year. We have a lot of work to do. The good news is that it's the exact same team, and we all know what we're doing. And if there was any kinks in the workflow or the process, we had a big post-mortem with all the teams, you know, with the music team and with my assistant editors, not to have a bitch fest, but basically just how do we do better? And it's like that team building, you know, and letting people have a voice and say, okay, we did this project together. How can we improve like the work, you know, the whole workflow and communication and getting excited again and just do the same, but better, you know? Hopefully.
You know, with like any musical is definitely spectacle. It's like, look at all of this. You know, you're being invited into the world. And I was watching, you know, thinking about you and what questions would be good to ask and everything. And I was like, oh no, I haven't been paying attention about like the editing and like all this stuff, which I think that means you've done your job really well, right? Is that I've completely lost the technical aspect of the film and I'm just like engaged in the conflict and the characters.
That's the biggest compliment you can give any editor, is that I got lost in the storytelling and I just got immersed in the experience. And when I watch a movie, it's exactly the same thing. I've seen it 3,000 times and I get lost in it. And I love it. I love it so much. It feels like all these, you know, those aspects of the movie, of all the different movies I ever loved as a kid and growing up and as an adult. And so, you know, it's supposed to be an invisible art for a reason, because you're supposed to it is supposed to all disappear, and you're supposed to talk about the dancing, not how you edited the dancing or how they sing the songs or how do they make that. You're supposed to just get lost in it. You know, if I could say one other thing, is that, you know, there's a lot of things about the pace of this movie being 2 hours and 40 minutes. And I think that I tried my best with John to really, you know, have a big canvas with the storytelling to give room for really connecting to these characters, but also to you know, live in the world of Oz. And then at the same time, just get lost in it. And if I had made like a 90-minute version of this, I don't think, or even 2 hours, which I've seen, by the way, I just wouldn't have been as satisfying. And so, you know, just trying to have a firm grip on the audience to not make them, their thoughts wander too much and get lost in it is the intent of every editor, but especially as something of this size, really tried our best to just keep you in there and give you a really full meal.
And full meal you did. How can people stay up to date with you, keep eyes on what you're working on?
Sure. I'm on Instagram, Nick Flicks. I'm posting a lot about Wicked right now, part one. I apologize, but there's a lot to celebrate. I'm hoping to give people some, insight into the process over the next couple months of how we made the film and some behind the scenes type of footage. There'll be some more stuff being shared about my editing process. And
all right, Myron, thanks so much for your time and excited to see part two.
Thanks, man. I really appreciate it. I hope your listeners get something out of this. And I'm really thankful to explain some of my process, and hopefully it helps. See you at the next one.